Well, it won't have anything to do with our interpretation anyway. As long as you know I've been through it, that's the main thing. Make sure you're in fellowship as we are here dissecting an analysis, verses 22 through 23, the final section of chapter 18, where we're in scene 3 of 11 scenes of Operation Sodom and Gomorrah. In this particular section, we have Abraham that engages in discourse with the Lord Yahweh after Yahweh determines to reveal to him his intentions, which Abraham correctly reads, in destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. In his approach, is quite lengthy. That's the first thing that jumps out at you. A series of questions. And in these questions you have a supposition, proposition, a certain number of people involved as it declines throughout the questions in the situation. Righteous existing with the wicked. And to what degree will Yahweh withhold judgment upon the cities in light of the number of righteous that may otherwise exist or live there in this situation? And in his questions, he doesn't say anything about Lot. Now, Lot's obviously on his mind. Lot, his nephew's living in Sodom. But his questions really are an appeal, doctrinal appeal, to God on behalf of nations overall. Therefore, the questions and the number of questions, the increments of which they are asked, of numbers, etc., all have bearance on the real intentions that's going on here in regards to Abraham asking Yahweh with respect to how many righteous can exist and God still withhold his judgment. Now, the judgment here is not on a personal basis in the form of divine discipline. It even goes beyond national discipline to a certain degree. The judgment we're looking at here is a complete annihilation of an entire society. Even the land, the geography, is laid waste and barren. Is not unlike the judgment of the planet beforehand at the flood, in the fact that God came in and he basically obliterated society with the exception of Noah and his family. So this is an aspect of doctrine that's going on here and is to be understood in the framework of Abraham's questions with respect to God's fairness and justice and what he will allow and what he won't allow in regards to bringing upon societies such a judgment otherwise in history. This is obviously very important for Abraham to know in his teaching and instruction in regards to those under him as it pertains to Israel and other nations, as he is to be the representative of the Abrahamic covenant otherwise in terms of blessing in regards to nations. How might we expect this judgment to occur? At what degree of evil, if you will, of this particular sin is it going to take for you to come in and do this? So that's what's going on here. That's presented to you in layman terms in regards to the real core of Abraham's questions in doing so. He obviously is then appealing on behalf of his nephew Lot, who lives in Sodom, in this vein. So, it's not just all about Lot here. It is a depth of understanding of doctrine of everything that I have tried to, at least in the best way I can, to pull out for you in regards to the initial questions. Abraham's involvement as a representative of the Abrahamic covenant, his positive volition, his responsibility to witness, etc., as it pertains to the judgment at hand, and that is, it's an appeal. It's a doctrinal clearing up, if you will, exactly at what point one might expect for God to step in and perform again such a judgment upon mankind. So this is kind of where this thing's headed at. And we brought out the fact that Abraham omits Lot's name. Obviously, Yahweh just revealed his omniscience. So in part, it's not necessary for Abraham to mention Lot. But still, it goes beyond that. And that's where we kind of left off here, point 11. Otherwise, Lot's omission of name strongly suggests that Abraham's intentions in conversing with Yahweh is not merely on behalf of Lot, but had deeper intentions. And 12, that is to establish a measure of grace that might be expected in history upon nations, societies, if you will, potentially facing such catastrophic consequences of judgment as will come upon and rain upon Sodom and Gomorrah in the region. 13, obviously this would have impact on believers such as Lot residing in nations. Another parallel to a certain degree is Revelation 18:4. The next prophetic recording, and this is a prophecy at this point in time in regards to Abraham in the present of Yahweh telling about Sodom. It hasn't happened yet. Obviously, it's behind us now, and it's a fulfilled prophecy. But prophetically, the next closest scenario we have where a society is completely obliterated, a national annihilation of peoples is prophetic Babylon. And in regards to prophetic Babylon, we see that for those who continue to exist, which prophetic Babylon is none other than the good U.S. of A. today, that after the rapture, nothing will, the only unbelievers will be on this planet at that point in time. When the rapture occurs, all church age believers still alive will be removed from the scene. And we enter into Daniel's 70th week. That 7-year period. God has will continue to make provision of evangelizing a potential positive volition during this time in history. He does so through means of the 144,000 Jews who are evangelized, if nothing else, by Elijah and Moses in regards to their appearance. And then you have angels that also will be instrumental in regards to proclaiming doctrine and evangelizing in that sense. And people will come to saving faith, and many will come to phase two faith also in this period of time. And obviously, prophetic Babylon, even though all believers have been removed, it's going to continue to go on. Life is going to continue to go on just with the void, and people will try to answer in their own minds, et cetera, what all's happened here, pass it off to aliens or whatever. But you will have doctrinal types and doctrine being presented otherwise, proclaiming the truth. And people will be evangelized. You will have people that would come to saving faith here in our country even after we're gone. And a warning is given to them. You need to get the hell out of Dodge before God brings the catastrophic judgment that He's going to bring upon them. And that's made clear in the passage dealing with prophetic Babylon in 18:4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye may not participate in her sins, that ye may not receive of her plagues. The plagues is essentially culminates in a complete destruction in 1 hour, 1 day. And we'll see if all those fancy bunkers, the survival bunkers, will work for the people. If the rich like the tout that they own and all these other things. No, it won't. It's going to be such a nuclear holocaust that the radiation will seep into everything. Nobody's going to escape this. If you ever want an idea what kind of destruction it brings about, just look at some of the old World War II pictures of Japan being nuked by our country. See? And the devastation, the illnesses and everything that's caused by all that. But anyway, here you have an indication of grace that goes over and beyond, really, preceding the judgment. And it gives opportunity for those who are of Jewish persuasion or otherwise, who are believers, to hear the doctrine that prophetic Babylon is going to be destroyed and you need to relocate. Here's one time where God's geographical will is going to change big time in regards to people that are believers otherwise still living in our country. The majority of Jews, obviously, the emphasis is on the Jewish people. In that, as we recognize, one of the largest segment of Jews outside of the land are still live in our country. They've been basically drawn in regards to the life of luxury and other things that our country has to offer, and many will continue to live here. The number, I don't know exactly anymore, but it's definitely in the millions still continue to live in our country. So I bring that out to show that when God does determine to come down on society, nations, in such fashion, it's not without ample warning. It's not without ample doctrine. And it's not without deliverance. In regards to those who are His, who are believers otherwise, in regards to their lives. So, you take that, kind of put it into the picture here, in regards to what Abraham is asking Yahweh, in regards to Sodom and Gomorrah, which is a lesser picture. And you get the idea here where Abraham is coming from. So, to know, alright, God, when will you judge? See, will you judge it at this point? Will you judge it at this point? Etc. What's going on? So 4:14, this standard of measure in grace versus judgment is the way I term it. God permits under permissive will, and that's a form of grace for evil to exist and even thrive to a certain degree. So this standard of measure in grace versus judgment, point 14, allows for Yahweh's previous words to Abraham to now have doctrinal force in the present discourse. What we went into in Abraham's role with respect to the Abrahamic covenant, Israel, a national blessing otherwise, his responsibilities otherwise, in instructing and passing doctrine down the line otherwise, now has force. We don't leave the idea of nationalism, Israel and other nations, and center in just on one person here in Sodom. No, there's more than that. So 15, now the crux of the conversation here centers on a complete demise of a society by the hand of God, while silently recognizing Lot's involvement in the present context, Lot being a believer. A derelict believer, but a believer nevertheless. All right, 16. The sense of corporate or national emphasis is weaved throughout our verses with references to contrasting the righteous with the wicked as two separate entities or groups corporately, That phrase is used three times, verses 23, 25, and 28. And it's also implied in verses 29, 30, 31, and 32, viewing the city as a whole place or a whole city, not just part of the city, verses 24, 26, and 28. And then reference to all the earth, verses 25. So that gives you this idea of a corporate basis of his questioning. So 17, Abraham has just been given an important lesson on the importance of being positive and acquiring doctrine in relationship to national blessing versus judgment. That was the Bible class, preceding Bible class, part of that Bible class that he is now involved in. 18, this was framed in a manner of discourse designed to pique interest, drawing him into conversation, and testing his frame of reference doctrinally. In the situation, Abraham basically was a third-party observer drawn into conversation by default. Yahweh didn't have to be looking at him. Yahweh is intentionally, it's just a method that he's using to get Abraham's attention. And he's speaking, if you will, to the two men, the two angels with him. But by default, it's about Abraham. And of course, Abraham's there, his ears are up, and he's hearing it. And all this is to draw from Abraham a reaction. And this is what we're finding. This is now what we're seeing is Abraham's reaction in a doctrinal response in regards to this. He just heard all that Yahweh had to say in regards to his person, his polyvolition, and the importance of Bible doctrine as it pertains to the matter. So 19, Abraham gapped the intent of the conversation. See, there is intent that goes along with the words of context. And here Abraham gaps that intent of the conversation and now responds, evidencing the doctrine in his soul while showing his continued desire to learn even more in the process. It's really pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff. What's going on here when you are able to peel away the top layer of Lot and see the real intention of Abraham's questions. He responds in a way the accolades, and that's what they were, that Yahweh placed upon him as being a recipient of the Abrahamic covenant, shows himself to be worthy, see, in regards to his postulation. And in so doing, he's also investigating, and he is wanting to know more doctrine to complement that which he obviously has confidence in already and has a good handle and understanding on. So 20, his questions here reflect both the doctrine that he knows, stated with confidence, and the doctrine he desires to gap otherwise. In that vein, the less certain as to God's will, we'll see in his questions, the more diffident or reserved he becomes. The series of questions, the first three are all rhetorical. The rhetorical questions show his confidence, whether they're no or yes. Then the next questions are he's seeking further. He's looking for more doctrine. And the further he asks or he delves into this thing, kind of more reserved he becomes. Because he obviously recognizes that he can't push the envelope too far in regards to the questions that will come forth. But all this points and evidences his positive volition. That's point 21. Abraham shows he possesses the qualities of phase 2 positive volition, validating God's choice to appoint him as a recipient of the Abrahamic covenant, being an effective witness to others. 22, he is a continuous seeker of truth, adamant or confident in what he knows, then showing restraint otherwise. So you get both sides of the barrel in regards to people, and when it comes to doctrine and inquiring or wanting to know, those that don't want to know. Abraham's not that. He continually is looking for the truth. And then you have those who otherwise think they know and have no restraint, are not patient and waiting upon God. As we'll see, the questions come one at a time. The answers then come one at a time. Doctrine is not one of those things where you go in and all of a sudden you learn everything in one Bible class. You know, that's the way the Thundies like to try to do things. Shove it all down your throat of what they think the spiritual life, Christian life is all about. Church camp or whatever. See, no, it's a continuous, ongoing process. Polyvolition. Polyvolition will find that they never lose the desire to know and understand the truth to the far and the degree possible that God will reveal it to them. But yet, on the other end of the coin, as Abraham will reflect, you seek, but obviously you recognize that God is going to reveal to you what He wants to reveal to you. And beyond that, you just wait upon God to see if indeed He will provide the answer otherwise. Just common sense, common logic, the doctrine of the blatantly obvious coming out of this. 23, with the two angels now on their way, getting in, that kind of gives you a layer to stand on, to rest on in regards to looking at the rest of this now. 23, with the two angels on their way. The context picks up with Abraham mulling over all that has just been said as he was still standing before the Lord. Now, sometimes when you read, you kind of lose sight of timing and things of this nature. Jesus had the conversation. The two men, then after that, after whatever, a few seconds or a minute or whatever, they turn around and they head out towards Sodom. And Abraham's sitting there and he's thinking about this. And what else would you expect? You just saw Yahweh, the divine essence, reveal his thinking processes, his contemplation. Abraham is doing it. He's a reflection. He's an imitator of God. See? And then he's contemplating all that has just been said. And he pulls it all together in his thinking. And he definitely has his act together. Coming in approaching Yahweh in the manner of which we have recorded for us here. 24, having gapped the doctrine with its intent, i.e., the principle of blessing upon nations in righteousness and justice versus judgment. Having gapped the doctrine with his intent and collecting his thoughts, he approaches Yahweh then to engage in conversation, and he came near and said, all right, he walks up to him to have a mano-a-mano, if you will. One-on-one. All right, 25. Now, there is a pattern in the discourse between Abraham and Yahweh. There's a pattern that can be established in this respect. 26. Abraham puts in a sixfold plea for the city. Each time, it's accepted by the Lord. Even as Abraham pushes the envelope, he never pushed it so far that Yahweh said, no. That's one smart dude, man. 27, each time essentially he asks, suppose there are X number of righteous, who lay then whatever number, 50, 40, 5, 40, 30, etc. Ulay Sadiq. Then every time, God accedes to his supposition. He says, okay. Correct. 28. Abraham starts confidently in verses 23 through 25. And then he ends with a final and hesitant, oh, may the Lord not be angry, in verse 32. 29. On the other hand, every instance, Yahweh accepts his possibility, his supposition. The tone of acceptance progressively becomes cooler in and of itself. So that gives you the temperature of attitude as it pertains to the situations. Be grace heading towards judgment. 30, Abraham begins with the positive words, Yahweh begins with the positive words, "If I find, I will spare," in his responses to Abraham's question, in Matzah Nasa. 31, he then ends with the more ominous, "I will not destroy it on account of it, Lo Shekath Bet Abur." 32, now the number of the righteous are presented in decreasing increments of fives and tens. That's another thing that kind of catches your eye. Begins with 50, dropping 5 two times to 45 and 40, and ending with series of 10s to 30, 20, and 10. 33, ironically, it should not go unnoticed that in biblical numerology, 5 equals grace and 10 equals to perfect law, which parallels the parameters of this discourse, grace unto judgment. Now, if there's any further symbolism of 50 and the numbers in and of themselves, it'll take somebody smarter than me to figure that out. And I'm not sure how you plug in Jubilee and all that other stuff that might be pertaining to that. But the easy one's there. And I couldn't help but bring that out. Because when you're studying stuff and you're saying, well, this is why I think I'm seeing it here and all this other stuff, and you run across something like this, you go, bingo. That's what's going on. Grace unto judgment. That is the parameters of his and reasoning for his question. 34, Abraham begins by establishing his doctrinal foundation of argument. "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?" This is the foundation of the argument. Sweeping away the righteous with the wicked. 33, the question is the first of three rhetorical questions in this series of questions. Those rhetorical ones are verse 23a, 24b, and 25c. In the list of questions, it expects a no answer, with the exception of the final one. It mimics Yahweh's approach in question verse 17. The first two expect a no. The third expects a yes. But for this point, the first question does expect a no answer. "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?" No. And that is rhetorical, mimics Yahweh's starting the conversation back, because he started off with a rhetorical question. "Shall I reveal to Abraham what I'm about to do?" See. So just a parallel to bring out. So 36, now the rhetorical nature of these questions reveals Abraham's confidence at its utmost. Where he is totally confident in his proclamations in regards to Yahweh in this respect. 37, then all following unrhetorical questions that will follow then suggests a progressive lack of assuredness, revealing his desire to continue further discernment. From 50, and then you get down to 45, okay, now I'm starting to, I'm not sure, I'm not quite as sure as I was on the first one, and I'd like to know. Then 40, and it's less, see, is what's going on. So 38, that the first two questions are rhetorical in verses 23 and 24, is seen in Abraham's resolute statement of verse 25. "Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you." See how adamant he is. And then the third rhetorical question, "Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" That rhetorical question obviously expects a yes answer. But in all cases of these rhetorical questions, it shows utmost confidence in the doctrine at hand. So, with respect to his statements, his adamant statements of what Yahweh would or wouldn't do. 39, so the doctrinal foundation here of slaying the righteous with wicked so that they're treated alike. No, you would not do that. You are a judge of the earth dealing justly. So 39, so the doctrinal foundation here appeals to God's fairness in execution of his justice in the form of wrath, the annihilation that he's going to bring upon Sodom, while disregarding like consequences upon those aligned with his righteousness otherwise. So the crux of the of Abraham's questions, what I'm saying here, of sweeping away the righteous with the wicked, the foundation of his questions, is appealing to God's fairness in execution of his justice. The justice is his righteousness in action against that which is unrighteous. See, we just went through that. And would God do that disregarding like consequences then coming upon those who were aligned with his righteousness otherwise? So the sense of this question here, the sense of his questions and his proclamations, 40, in other words, which is weightier in God determining to implement a judgment of wrath upon societies? Which is weightier with God? The presence of evil or God's plan of grace for the righteous in spite of evil? When you unravel the intent of the questions and the intent of the context, that's essentially what he's asking God here. What's going to be weightier, your grace or the judgment upon evil in spite of righteousness otherwise? So, again, point 40. In other words, which is weightier in God determining to implement a judgment of wrath upon societies? The presence of evil or God's plan of grace for the righteous in spite of evil? How evil can a society get, and how long will God withhold judgment on behalf of the righteous? That's what he's asking. 41, the doctrine of the blatantly obvious. And which is weightier in that regard, your grace or your judgment? So 41, the doctrine of the blatantly obvious is that God spares mankind throughout history on behalf of the righteous. Verse 26b, in his response, then I will spare the whole place on their account. It's on behalf of the righteous. Your preposition, bet with a bur, used four times. Compare verse 29b, on account of the 40, and then etc., verses 31b and 32b, on account of the righteous. I'll spare the entire place. So the doctrine of blatantly obvious is that the righteous, God's grace towards the righteous, is a hell of a lot weightier than his judgment is in regards to coming upon the evil of societies otherwise that would directly, obviously, otherwise affect the righteous in the judgment in that respect, wipe them out. All right, 42. Now the righteous and wicked, Tzaddik and Rasha, distinguish between two opposite categories of humanity. 43. Many interpret that these two terms relate solely to behavior. Solely to behavior. Well, Lot mitigates against that. 44. First and foremost, is that they are related to saving faith. It's language used to describe believers and unbelievers. Those who are justified by faith, point 44, like Lot, and those that whatever their behavior are still outside the plan of God, they are remain in unbelief. So the Bible looks at believers and unbelievers in different categories of righteousness and unrighteousness. And each category titles whether they're a believer or they're an unbeliever. The righteous simply refer often in the Bible to believers, no matter what they are experientially. Unrighteous, looking at their unbelieving counterparts. And that looks at the fact, point 45, all men are born enemies of God due to spiritual death brought on by the mere possession of an STA, as we understand the reason of the dilemma that mankind has found itself in regards to this world. And in that condition, we are in the unbeliever is in a state of perpetual unrighteousness. They are in the complete slavery, a hold of the sin nature and all that will bring upon them, not only physically, but spiritually, including eternal damnation, eternal death, if they don't break that hold. So all unbelievers, no matter how good they may be, humanitarian or whatever, are still evil before God. They do not have the dressing of God's absolute righteousness as part of their makeup that all believers have, called the human spirit. 46, the righteous at its most basic level are those that possess imputed plus are. Exercising faith and God's righteousness is reckoned to their account. In the Lamb's Book of Life, it's realized in an accounting procedure. The human spirit is the spiritual apparatus used as a token of that plus are in regards to the believer's makeup, changing them from dichotomous to trichotomous, of two parts to three parts, body, soul, and spirit. 15:6, Abraham's faith was reckoned there as righteous, as righteousness, as we saw there. Also reaffirm Romans 4:5. Where it's used in regards to essentially phase one faith. But the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, has faith apart from work. So hence, salvation phase one. His faith is reckoned as righteousness. So every believer is righteous before God, positionally, through our union in Jesus Christ. Again, experientially, there may be something totally, completely opposite of that. They may be living a life acting just like their unbelieving counterparts. So the Bible uses the term righteous versus unrighteous or evil in this most general of terms to define or recognize believers versus unbelievers. 47, the wicked or evil are those that are spiritual criminals living their lives in the prison of spiritual death on the other end of the coin. 48, we are to understand the rhetorical questions. Would you indeed sweep away believers with unbelievers? That is the idea of the foundation of Abraham's questions. 49, the presupposition of the Old Testament is that, quote, the Lord loves the righteous, that's believers, but the way of the wicked he brings to ruin. That's ultimate and complete destruction. Psalm 146, 8 and 9. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord raises up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord protects the strangers and supports the fatherless and the widow. But he brings to ruin the way of the wicked, literally, thwarts. As verse 25 indicates, in our immediate context, to slay believers with unbelievers in the act of judgment would be a grave oversight. Far be it from you. See, no way a fair God would do this, to bring about the same condemnation upon believers in a society of unbelievers otherwise. So what this is doing is dissecting, even at its deepest point, how God interacts and deals with mankind, beginning first and foremost in the two primary categories, whether they're believers versus unbelievers. And no, judgment is not the same. Judgment is not the same. So you got to throw that in the mix. This is going on. Now in verse 24, suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Verse 24, Abraham reframes the doctrinal premise now, adding a supposition to the expected no answer. Hypothetically, suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? 52, in the first two questions of rhetorical significance, Abraham views God's actions of wrath as a communal effect, using the Hebrew verb translated sweep, which is safah. It indicates the process of heaping things together in removal. So he's looking at the righteous and the wicked in a complete package in the act of judgment. 53, in reality, it looks to God putting to death, here in the context as it pertains to situation as it might occur as Sodom or otherwise. So in reality, it looks to God putting to death, point 53, the entire population, as noted by the verb slay, muth, to kill, in verse 25a. 54, now the significance of the numbers used of the righteous is to also be viewed as a community of believers more so than simply believers independently. These numbers, 50 righteous, 45, 40, etc. The idea here is you're looking at a community within a society more so than just separate. You know, you got to separate personal divine discipline apart from what's going on here. So the significance of the numbers, whether it be 50, 45, 40, etc., is also to be viewed as a community, the city as a whole, etc. All that idea. Believers more so than simply believers independently. 55, each supposition looks to a viable community of believers, a unit of them, if you will, as we might recognize in a local church today. We're a community of believers here. Sometimes close to 50. Sometimes a little over. Most of the time not. But we're still a community of believers. So this is kind of the idea that's going on here. Because you got to look beyond just the individual thing. You're looking at an entire society, a situation in a society or in a nation. In Sodom, if there was a community of believers there, 50 strong, this is the idea. Would you destroy that whole city? See. These assemblies would be prevalent, obviously, at the time of history here. And as 50 suggests in the first supposition, sizable enough that they would be recognized by the community at large, at least in the historical context. To have a church 50 strong in Sodom, the people of Sodom, since they were not the large metroplexes as we find a lot today, they would be generally recognized. They would have, if you will, a witness. In a certain sense, regards to their very presence as a community. In 50, the sizes are prevalent. They're at least noticeable in this regard. 57, the final phrase of verse 24, who are in it? Asher bet Kareb in its midst. implies that these may find themselves in such a wicked society through no fault of their own. Through no fault of their own. 58, this illustrates the reality that believers predominantly are a minority of mankind surrounded by a mass of unbelievers throughout history. We live in a country. We can't force it nationally to conduct itself in any certain form of conduct, morally or otherwise. See? But this is what God's geographical will is for us as a community of believers. We're not under any imperatives to come out of her yet. See? And we can't help it, you know. If everybody goes homo on us, that's out of our control. And it may be of such gravity that you know, they need to be wiped out. But would God wipe it out if there was a sizable community of believers existing in that situation? See, that's what's going on here. And it points to the fact that always, throughout history, generally, with exceptions, a couple of exceptions, like right after the flood and right after the second advent and the rapture. Well, not the rapture, but the second advent. Nothing but believers on the planet. But how long does that last? Yeah. Predominantly, throughout history, believers are the utmost minority on this planet to begin with. Even more of a minority are adjusted believers. Matthew 22:14, and that principle is made clear in Jesus' own teaching. For many are called, but few are chosen. We are the minority. So Abraham now is, if you will, kind of inserting another layer to this proposition that he's laying out to Yahweh. In your acts of judgment upon mankind, throughout history, Yahweh, believers are going to be in the minority. What about them that find themselves in a society that demands justice, execution of justice from you, otherwise in disregards? If, in other words, if they weren't there, God probably would rain on them without any question. See. So 59, the clause in verse 25, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike, looks to the shortening of the lives of believers along with the wicked, wiping everyone out together. That's the idea. In that case, it would in part preclude the plan of God for believers to finish their course based on the unrighteousness of others. That wouldn't be fair. See how much doctrine is involved in this thing, man. God is going to provide for that believer to express their positive volition to finish their course. To perform God's plan for their life. To be caught up in some type of judgment and such catastrophic effects where it's going to wipe them out along with all these rest of these believers would not be fair for that person. It would cut them off short. See? And that because of the unrighteousness of others. God is not a God that's going to condemn the righteous because of unrighteousness of others. Further, we project a God as without mercy, even for his own, in an action proclaiming the condemnation of believers at the same level as unbelievers. How would this witness to the rest of the world? Well, God doesn't care for his own. He wiped out Sodom, but there was a group of believers there, 50 strong. And he wiped them out with them. What kind of witness would that be? And so, I know sometimes maybe I have some difficulty getting things over, but you have the idea again of judgment that's coming in regards to this society. And God is not going to deal with those who are His own the same He's going to deal with those who are otherwise remain alien to Him in unbelief. God does not execute His justice in such manner as this. So, our time's more than up. I'll take another breath Tuesday, and we'll readdress this then. Father, again, we thank You for the truth of Your Word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to light us to these things. In Jesus' name, amen.